Craig Berg. It's exactly 10 after 8. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm happy to be sitting opposite Catherine Keenan, who is Senior Director of Corporate Foundation Relations at Carthage and also part of Carthage's Business and Professional Coalition. And we're going to be talking about what all that means and also about a really important event, which is coming up on November 9th. It is Carthage's Sustainable Development Roundtable, which is going to be an opportunity to explore some ways in which development can be done in sustainable fashion. And of course, in the world in which we live and with our increasing awareness of the fragility of the natural environment around us, when we see development occur, it becomes more and more evident that we need to be careful about the way in which we develop, in which we build businesses and neighborhoods and so on, and the whole nature of that and how we do that will be explored in this event coming up. And I'm really glad that Catherine Keenan can be with us to talk about this event and beyond that, even the mission of the Carthage Business and Professional Coalition. Catherine Keenan, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here.
So glad we can have you. Ahead of us talking about all of those specifics, tell us a little bit more about your specific role at Carthage, your responsibilities.
Sure. Well, as the Senior Director of Foundation and Corporate Relations, I am primarily a grant writer. So a lot of the work that I do is developing proposals for private, corporate, or family foundations to help fund different programs that we have going on at Carthage. So it's a wonderful role. I get to work with faculty and staff, learn about the amazing things that they're doing, and help promote it to people that want to support us.
Very good. Tell us more about the Carthage Business and Professional Coalition and the kind of things that they have been doing over the last few years.
Great. So the Business and Professional Coalition is a public engagement series. This is part of my role on the corporate relations side of the position. And Kenosha has an extraordinarily strong local economy and some really wonderful organizations and people that are invested in this region. So the BPC is a way for some of the professional leaders in the area to come together and generate conversation about mutual concerns, issues that are affecting the growth of business in the region, the development of the region. And so we're led by a steering committee. Among them, Bob Lee, Carla Crable from Johnson Financial Group, Dave Riley, Tom Mahoney from State Bank of the Lakes. We also have several nonprofit members of the steering committee. So Carolyn Frisch from United Way of Kenosha County, Tatiana Biankin, who is the executive director of Building Our Future Kenosha. So we have a wide range of leaders that come together and generate topics that we want to discuss in this luncheon format.
And that's such an important thing to do because, I mean, it's one thing to kind of sit alone in a room in splendid isolation and kind of dream up what people are going to be interested in seeing or hearing. And it sounds like what this is all about is really connecting to exactly what people are already interested in and really hungry to know more about. And so what kinds of things have happened recently then with this group?
Thanks. So we reinstituted it after a pause in, I think, 2019 or 2020, and I've been assisting, coordinating these events since 2021. And so since I've kind of taken the reins in coordinating, what we're really trying to do is have substantive topics. So in the past, sometimes it's been kind of showy speakers, and those are super exciting and they get a lot of people in the door. But I really wanted to encourage people to have conversations that might lead them to, you know, make new decisions about their businesses and really have, you know, generate new opportunities for our region. So we have had conversations about mental health in the workplace, right? What are some of the solutions that employers are using to support mental health of their employees? We've had speakers about the supply chain crisis. Earlier this year, we had a speaker from Thornton Tomasetti, an expert engineering consulting firm, and they helped construct the Ascent Tower in Milwaukee. So
yes.
Our speaker is resident of Kenosha, Jordan Comp, and he was the project lead for Thornton Tomasetti's role in this construction, which was actually extraordinarily important. It was essentially the fire safety lead and ensuring that the core material of this amazing project, mass timber, was fire safe and could support an extended secure structure in the event of a fire so that everybody in the building can get out. So really incredible work. We learned so much about that building and about this material, mass timber, that is going to permit tall buildings to be made out of a very sustainable resource.
Wow.
Yeah.
So tell us about this special event now that is going to be coming up on November 9th and in a sense, the ground that you are hoping to cover in this event.
Sure. So next week we are hosting a roundtable program. So roundtable is slightly different. We will have a keynote speaker, Tim Duggan, but then the primary content of the event is the attendees sitting around tables talking with each other about a topic that they have signed up to discuss. So some of those topics include urban water systems, urban education is another one, ecosystems, regenerative building, so construction, landscape design, building in such a way that not only does it not harm the environment, but it might serve to regenerate plant life and animal life in an adaptive way. So what you'll notice from these topics is that sustainability is not limited to thinking about the immediate environmental impact, but also how you can grow in a way that supports all of the people that are part of an urban context. So with a table on urban education, for example, we really want to think about what are some of the challenges of education in very large school districts. And what can we do to ensure that everybody in a large school district, irrespective of their different economic backgrounds, gets an equitable and exceptional education? So that's one of the topics that our faculty member, Siobhan Williams, is going to lead. And we have another table that I'm hoping to fill on equitable property development. And certainly we know that in Kenosha, there's been a history of redlining. And so if you're in a space where you perhaps own rental buildings or you're a property developer, how do you succeed in that business while not repeating some of the mistakes of the past?
Right. And it's so interesting because sometimes we're talking about out-and-out mistakes, I mean, bordering on misdeeds, I mean, and sometimes not bordering. I mean, people doing wrong things and probably for the wrong reasons. And then, of course, it sounds like some of what you will touch on is also some of the inadvertent harm that's done when we just keep doing things the way we've always done them,
right.
When there is a better way to do things that serves the community in a better way and serves the environment in a better way. And so it sounds like this event is in part to just broaden our notion of what is possible out there.
Exactly. And that's what I'm hoping that our keynote speaker will bring to the table. So his name is Tim Duggan. He's a landscape architect, and he's really made a name for himself in disaster recovery. Hmm. So he worked for the Make It Right Foundation. They built homes in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and as well as in the aftermath of a major tornado in Greenfield, Kansas. So what he's going to bring to the table is when we are building, when we are rebuilding, you know, how can we reinvent and redesign the urban context so that it's healing rather than harmful, or as you say, you know, repeating the same mistakes. So how can we use architecture to heal after destruction? And so there's a lot more to that question than just build a good house. But, you know, how do you cultivate community in the way that you arrange a neighborhood? So those are some of the questions, certainly, that he thinks about every day. But we're going to ask him to challenge us to, you know, discuss those sort of reinvention, redesign questions across all of these topics.
Wow. You know, it's interesting as you're describing that, you kind of realize that it's if one is environmentally sensitive or concerned, we tend to fall back on the fairly simplistic notion of development bad.
Right.
I mean, we just have to stop building things. We have to stop building buildings. We have to stop creating roads. We have to just stop all that or slow it down or whatever. And I'm sure in certain environments, maybe that's true. But it sounds like part of what this is about is redefining development, mm-hmm. and the fact that it does not need to necessarily always be harmful or not harmful in the way that it's always been. And that's really exciting to think about that kind of radical redefinition going on.
Thank you. Yeah, we really want to encourage people, especially with the context of the Business and Professional Coalition. We want to encourage people to succeed and grow our economy, and that's going to benefit Kenosha more broadly. But the questions that we're addressing in this event, in the previous event, and also in the rest of the events of this series are really more about, you know, how can we grow and succeed while also being good stewards of the communities that we come from and the environment that we inhabit.
Hmm. So this event is coming up on November 9th, the Sustainable Development Conference?
Roundtable
at Carthage College. So who is welcome to attend this? I mean, I suppose in a sense anybody, but I mean, who are you especially thinking about? I mean, where this would be, you think, particularly valuable for them?
Well, certainly we aim our content toward professionals, working people, business owners. There are tables, as I said, on property development, education. We also have a table on creative economies, so the creative sector and how that's a growth industry. So we really want you to attend, not just if you have a general interest in business, but if you have an interest in, you know, succeeding in a way that also serves others.
Yeah, I love that.
That's what we really want to accomplish here. And so, you know, education sector, construction, property development, creative economies, and as well as several tables on these more traditional environmental sustainability questions.
Sure.
So urban water systems and urban ecologies. We're going to have a real well-rounded set of topics.
And if people want to attend and participate in this, what do they need to do?
They need to go to www.carthage.edu/businesscoalition. And on that page, you'll find a description of this event with an RSVP link. And when you sign up, make sure you choose your table topics of interest so that we can seat you appropriately.
Very good. Catherine Keenan is Senior Director of Corporate Foundation Relations at Carthage and part of Carthage's Business and Professional Coalition, helping to oversee this upcoming event, the Sustainable Development Roundtable, on November 9th. Thank you for being here for the morning show. It was great to talk with you, and we hope that a lot of people take in this exciting opportunity.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to The Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview that comes from The Morning Show archive. I think just about all of us will agree that the world needs to be a more peaceful place, and certainly we can look around us and see all kinds of evidence that that in fact we are not at peace, and not just in places where there is open warfare, but even within our own individual lives and in our communities, there is a need for peace, for a more harmonious coexistence and a spirit of cooperation and compassion with one another. One of the most interesting books I have seen on this topic is a book just published called Putting Peace First: Seven Commitments to Change the World. The author of the book is Eric David Dawson, who is the CEO of an organization called Peace First, which he helped to create right around the time that he graduated from high school. As a very young person, Eric David Dawson was interested in trying to be a peacemaker in his own community. And he has taken that cause to higher and higher levels. And in fact, Peace First works not only here but abroad as well to try to galvanize young people in particular to be peacemakers. And we're going to be exploring some of what he talks about in this book, which is published by Viking. Again, it's called Putting Peace First. Eric David Dawson, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You open the book with something very interesting in the prologue, in which you talk about how you as a young person would have been somebody that we would not have maybe immediately thought of as a peacemaker in the making. The first sentence of the book is, "I was a pretty angry kid." You mean that in a particular way. Describe to our listeners the way in which you were actually a very angry kid.
So, I don't think I'm unusual in this, in that as a young person, I picked up on a lot of the adult hypocrisy around me, where adults would talk about one thing being important and then model something different. I was frustrated by the injustices that I saw around me and my lack of perceived power to make a difference. And the reason I wanted to start with that invitation is because there are young people all over our country who are angry. And what we tend to do is dismiss anger as a bad thing. And what I wanted to invite young people to do is to think about their own anger, their own frustration, not as negative, but as an opportunity to leverage those emotions to try to heal a very broken world.
So explain how you first, in a sense, became a peacemaker in your own community, in your own backyard. What were some of the first efforts which you personally undertook?
So I went to a very large public high school in the Midwest, and this was the start of the inclusion movement, which meant that young people with disabilities who'd been kept in substantially separate learning environments for most of their education were being mainstream, joining the regular ed population for health class and lunchtime and gym class, and basically got the crap beat out of them, either physically or emotionally. And so as a 14-year-old with a group of other young people, that really connected to my sense of justice. And so I began organizing at my school to change the way that students treated one another. So rather than the principal saying, "Where is there a tolerance school? We don't do that," it was student to student saying, "This is not who we are." And it worked. It changed the culture of our school, made it a more accepting, tolerant, welcoming place. And of course, it didn't feel like enough. So with my fellow students, began creating a district-wide training program for every fourth, fifth, and sixth grader around inclusion of people with disabilities. And so for me, it was the first time I got to feel powerful in a way that it wasn't about hurting someone else, but creating new opportunities. Mm.
In the book's introduction that follows the prologue, you talk about a big lie that young people are told again and again, and it is a lie that is delivered with the best of intentions, but nevertheless, in your mind, is a counterproductive lie. I want to read the first paragraph and then have you take it from there. This is the book's introduction. "You are the future. The scene could be from any assembly at any school anywhere in the world. An inspirational speaker sweating in the bright lights of the auditorium, explaining how important you will be someday. It seems from the moment you are born, adults are talking about your bright future, how with hard work, focus, and determination, you will be a great writer, athlete, leader, teacher, artist, whatever, someday. How at some distant point in the future, you will change the world. This is a lie." Explain how this is a lie.
So I'm smiling. I was invited to be a graduation speaker at an elementary school, and I opened it up with, the students are sitting in front of me, all the faculty and parents, and I said, your teachers and parents have been lying to you. That didn't go over quite as well as I'd hoped. But we do that, right? Our narratives about young people is they are victims that we need to protect or potential victims. They're perpetrators that we need to punish. So we incarcerate young people. We medicate young people. We turn our schools into prisons, literally, with metal detectors, police officers, or we locate their power in the future, right? We go in and we tell young people they're going to be great artists, leaders, writers, activists, thinkers someday in the distant future. And the intention is good, right? The intention is to locate our hopes and our dreams and visions for young people and who they can be. But the practice is so disempowering, right? The message is so disempowering because what we're telling young people is you have to wait, that you can't do these things now. And in fact, if you look at the research, young people are some of our most powerful innovators because of their proximity to the problem, and also because they are not fettered in the ways of thinking. They're not sort of trapped in the systems that say, "Well, we just can't do that."
Hmm. And it's so interesting to think about how, when we deliver that message, that in a sense might inadvertently disconnect young people from getting into the thick of the work of peacemaking, we're in a sense robbing the cause of some of the people that might be the most effective.
That's right. And our country is full of that in our history, whether it's Native Americans, African Americans, and the lack of citizenship, women unable to vote, and so I think our complicated arc of justice is trying to draw the circle of citizenship, and then I use that term broadly, sort of feeling like you're both an owner and a contributor and have power within the system, of trying to draw that circle bigger and bigger. And I think young people need to be included in that circle.
In this same chapter, this same introduction, you make a really important point, I think, that's worth exploring when you say, peace can be a difficult idea to wrap your hands around. It can seem passive, being weak and letting others take advantage of you. It can feel soft and fuzzy, sitting in a quiet meadow, holding hands and singing songs. It is often defined by what it is not. No conflicts and fewer weapons. And it can seem unattainable, needing to measure up to iconic leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., Gandhi, and Mother Teresa. But peace can also be strong and active. It can be daring and bold, and it is something you can do every day. So what is the way in which you are thinking about peace and peacemaking within the context of this book? Because that word can mean very different things to different people, as you've just alluded to in this paragraph.
It's such a great question. And, you know, language matters, right? The language that we use. And, you know, I come out of the violence prevention field where I work and got my start really helping to prevent violence. And what I realized is that so much of that language was negative. It was about stopping young people from doing things. It was looking at young people as diseased. And so what I wanted to do through this reclaiming of the word peace is to take something that everyone agrees is a good thing, right? There's not really an anti-peace crowd out there, right? The sense that, oh, yeah, peace is great. Like, we want peace. But it's almost lost its meaning. And so we wanted to take this word that's global and big and create something that was meaningful and muscular for young people. It's something they could have as an identity. Like, I'm a peacemaker. Like, that's what I do. That's who I am. And so for us, peacemaking is grounded in three big ideas. One is compassion, the ability to cross lines of difference to see other people's needs as your own. And so I write about this commitment to opening your heart. Courage, the ability to take a risk, to stand up for yourself, for someone else, for an idea. And then collaborative leadership. So wanting to move away from the narratives of single individuals driving change and reflecting how change happens, which is, you know, networks of people getting together to make the world a better place. So we wanted to, in this book, create language that soared, that invited young people to be part of something big, but then also made it very specific. Right, peacemaking is when you offer your seat to someone. You know, peacemaking is learning someone else's point of view. Peacemaking is the art of putting into practice this commitment to take risks and work with others. Mm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Eric David Dawson. He is the CEO and co-founder of the group Peace First and the author of a brand new book called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. In some respects, the heart and soul of your book involves those seven commitments, which you call your Peacemaker Manifesto, a set of commitments to guide you on your journey. Tell our listeners about the Peacemaker Manifesto.
You know, as I was putting this book together, what I realized is we spend so much time asking young people what they want to do when they grow up, right? That's our message. Like, what do you want to do? But we don't spend enough time asking young people who they want to be right now. And so the idea of writing this as a manifesto, and I co-created and I wrote this with a group of young people. So their language, their ideas infused the creation of it, is I wanted to give a set of principles by which young people can structure their lives. So rather than saying in situation A, this is what you should do, situation B, this is what you should do, ground young people in a set of beliefs and practices about what it means to move through the world with a peacemaking lens. And I love the idea of a manifesto, right? This thing that you sign on to that represents how you see the world and how you see yourself in the world.
I want you to talk for a moment about one of these specific commitments, and I think it's very interesting within the context of the others. Put peace first every day, raise my hand. I mean, get in there, open my heart, take a stand, bring others along, keep trying. All very, very obvious and clearly true. The one that probably is a little bit tricky for some people is commitment six, or maybe the trickiest, I should say, of the seven. Work with my enemies. I will cross lines of difference to get things done. I will not let history, fear, or mistrust keep me from connecting with people who can help. I can find common cause on a few things without needing to agree on everything. Of all of these seven commitments, this is probably the one that is the most timely and probably in some respects the most intimidating, just given the culture in which we're living right now. Describe more about what you're thinking of here and maybe how this has been true for you and how it can be true for all of us when we learn to somehow work with our enemies.
I love that you center on that one. One, because it was the language that I put in there, I got a lot of pushback on that. That seemed negative, that the sense that we've got enemies is not the way to locate this. I did because I wanted to play with that language, because we do define people as our enemies, whether that kid in school who's unkind to us or the political party that's against things that we believe in. And when you define someone as your enemy, it gives this sense of they're excluded from our circle of concern, right? We draw our circles of concern smaller and smaller. You know, originally it was called work with unlikely allies. And I really wanted to lift up this language because it felt so important right now. You know, and the story I tell as part of this work is Babatunde, a young man from Baltimore who walking home from school, was stopped by the police on suspicion of something or other, and handcuffed, thrown to the ground, and threatened, and then released. And not an unusual experience for a young man of color in Baltimore. And you know, he took that experience and he interviewed other young people of color about their experiences. You know, 17 years old. But he didn't stop there. He then went and interviewed police officers and asked them about their experiences. What's it like when you walk up to a group of young people you don't know? What goes through your mind? And his insight was that police officers and young people are terrified of each other because they don't know each other. And so designed this really innovative training that brought together police officers and young people to act out different scenarios where the police officers had to be young people and vice versa. In these high-pressure, high-stakes situations to create that sense of empathy. And what for me was so moving about Babatunde's story is that he went and worked with police officers against a tremendous amount of pressure not to do that from his community, from his friends, from police officers, you know, who were very resistant to having a 17-year-old come and tell them what to do. You know, what's so powerful is what he realized is that the enemy, you know, quote unquote, has got to be part of the solution. That you can't just work on this from the perspective of young people, but you have to change the system. In writing his story, I gave all the young people who I feature in the book a chance to just review it and make sure I'd captured what was right and true. And you know, where he pushed back on the way I told the story originally was that it seemed too neat. Like it had this arc that made it sound like everything was great. He grew to love police officers. And that wasn't true to his experience. He grew to understand that they too are victims of a system that dehumanizes everybody. But that it wasn't like he went through this experience and learned to love police officers and became a police officer himself. But rather, he came to see that there's an opportunity to partner around critical issues that can help liberate everyone. And so working with your enemy is about that. It's about realizing that our liberation is bound up together. You know, we can't fix sexism without changing the way we raise our boys. We just can't. And so that this message to young people is, who are people who disagree with you or might be standing in your way, and how can you enlist them in places where you have common ground?
Hmm. We're speaking with Eric David Dawson about his new book called Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World. It is, in a sense, a guidebook meant to be a galvanizing inspiration for young people to be peacemakers in their own communities, whatever that means, and around whatever issues are of a special concern for them. So we've already talked about your Peacemaker Manifesto and the seven commitments that comprise it. And then we should say that your book goes on to explore seven young people who have been peacemakers. You just told one of those stories, and each one of these seven commitments has a particular story attached to it. Tell us more about how you came to know these seven young peacemakers, and were they each peacemakers whom you have worked with through Peace First, or by other means did you come to know their own stories?
Yeah, and I should say, I would say one of the hardest parts of writing this book was choosing which stories to highlight. I could have written thousands of chapters about so many young people doing interesting, creative, dynamic work. So Peace First is a global platform for 13 to 25-year-olds who want to change the world and aren't quite sure where to start. So just as we run science fairs in communities, we run social justice fairs, if you will, digitally, helping young people identify an issue, create a solution, and then we invest in their ideas with money, mentoring, tools. And as part of this work, we have a prize, like a Nobel Peace Prize for young people to lift up and invest in young people's courageous work. And so through that, we've met, you know, thousands of young people who have done really creative, brave, compassionate peacemaking work. And so these are all young people that I met through the Peace First Prize process who are who felt like very human examples of what it takes to be a peacemaker. And so in crafting the stories, I wanted to lift up their extraordinariness, their bravery, their compassion, but also really focus on their ordinariness, that these young people have done some really cool, interesting things, but they're not superheroes. These are all things that we can do, and they are both exemplars, but also very, and they would be the first to say this, very flawed human leaders.
In some respects, the perfect embodiment of what you were just talking about is the story you tell around Commitment 7, which is Keep Trying, the subtitle of that. I will own my mistakes and learn from them. I will apologize for the hurt I cause and learn how to be a more caring person. I will remind myself and everyone around me that we don't have to be perfect. We just have to keep trying to do what is right and just. I really like the way you say that. Tell our listeners about the story of Mary Pat and the frustrations that were a part of the important work that she was trying to do in her own community.
Mary Pat is a young woman who was growing up just outside of Atlanta, and one of the observations she made to me in her interview was that as a 15-year-old, she had been to more funerals and graduations. That gun violence was a regular part of her life and a regular part of so many people's lives. And her idea was to take those same tools that we use to dissuade young people and adults from smoking cigarettes or using drugs, these shock ads, and apply it to gun violence. And her issue is, and she'd be the first to say, it isn't guns per se. It's the fact that guns are used to hurt and harm other people. And so she had this idea to create these public service announcements, these billboards that would get young people to think twice before picking up a gun. And she was really clear that she wanted to lift this up out of the sense that the gun violence is a problem just in the Black community or poor communities. But and we see this increasingly with these mass shootings and suicides, that gun violence is something that affects all of us. And so she had this idea and went to get help from advertising agencies, from billboard companies, from philanthropists, And again and again and again and again and again, the answer was no. You're too young. This won't work. It doesn't make sense. We ended up giving her a large grant to get this off the ground. And even then, the same billboards that put up advertising for strip clubs, it was scantily clad women in suggestive poses, wouldn't okay many of her images because they were too risque. These kind of messages around gun violence. But she got her billboards up, and she did it for a summer. And the police did this interesting study of her work, where they've got different districts, and the district where she put her billboards up had dramatic reductions in gun violence that summer. In the other districts, did not. Like, this great proof point of the effectiveness of what she's doing. And still, when she ran out of money, they took the billboards down, and back up went the pawn shops and the strip clubs. And she couldn't get anyone else to invest and believe in this idea. And one of the reasons I wanted to tell her story is, the way that we tell history is in reverse. So, of course Dr. King was going to lead the march in Selma. Of course the Montgomery bus boycott was going to be a success. But in the moment, none of those things were true. There's fear, there's confusion, there are mistakes. And so I wanted young people to know that that's part of their journey as well. The fact that they will make mistakes. We will make mistakes. There'll be confusions. There'll be failures. And that's an important part of the journey. And the commitment is to keep trying. The commitment is to get back up again and try something different.
And I appreciate that one of the other commitments, as you are talking about what people should be kind of thinking about and attempting, that the whole matter of courage, of being courageous, can look different to different people. I mean, we sometimes think of when somebody has courage or is courageous, it means this. And courage can take a lot of different forms. And even someone who is a very sort of shy, gentle, retiring kind of person can be just as courageous as kind of the larger-than-life figures in our life that we might more immediately and easily think of as being figures of courage and confidence and so on. I think it's a terrific idea to get not just young people, but all of us thinking in broader terms about the ways in which this can happen and the kinds of people who can be part of it.
I think that's exactly right. And some of this is connected to how we, think about power and privilege and what we tend to focus on. For me, courage is not about not being afraid, but it's what you do with that fear. And so what I want to encourage young people and really all of us to do is to think about risk. So many of us, when we encounter a situation, whatever it is, we tend to start with, what do I get out of it? We tend to locate ourselves around our own needs. Then most of us move to a place where we ask, what can I give? Right? We move to a place of generosity. But rarely do we make that next step and ask, what am I willing to give up? To talk about sacrifice. As I think about our country right now, I am most worried about that. This lack of investment in our public good. So we pull our kids out of the public school systems. We get fast track cards at Disney World, so we don't need to wait in the lines. There are private highways that are being built in California. That's sort of removing ourselves from the public space and the commitment to that public space. And so what I wanted young people to think about is not just like what they can give, but what are they willing to give up? And to me, that's what courage is. It's that risk taking. And so for one young person, it might be speaking up when they're terrified. It might be trying something new that they've never done before, where failure is likely. Or it might be sitting down and creating space for other people. So risk looks different for different people in different moments. But it's got to be part of our equation as we're looking to create the beloved community.
Absolutely. I want to say that your book goes on to spell out six steps for imagining and implementing a peacemaking project, where you choose a particular injustice or problem that you care about. You need to understand it, really look at what is the root cause of the problem. Imagine how you might solve it, or how that problem might be solved. Plan something, a solution, into concrete steps. Act, and keep acting when you hit bumps in the road, and then reflect as you are working and as the project completes, just thinking about the way it has happened and what you did and what the consequences were. I mean, I really think that's important, because as you alluded to earlier in the book, it's very easy to think about all of this in very nebulous terms. And clearly that's one thing you really want to avoid. You want people not only to have these compassionate, concerned thoughts about their community, but you want them to act on them, and you want this book to be a guide to help make that possible.
That's right. You know, to me, peacemaking has got to be embodied. You know, it's not enough to want things to happen, but you have to make things happen. And what I wanted to give to young people was a step-by-step guide on how to do it. Some young people know exactly what issues they want to tackle, others don't. Some young people know how to run and facilitate a meeting, others don't. And so this book is really a how-to guide, step-by-step workbook on how you create a peacemaking project. And it's supported by our digital platform at peacefirst.org that has the same tools to help young people create projects that have impact.
And I have to say that as inspiring as this book will surely be for young people, who are the readers for whom it is primarily designed and directed, that in fact anybody has a lot to learn from your book, and I'm sure you would agree.
That's my hope. There's been a lot of, I think, interest in student organizing after the shootings in Parkland, Florida. And a lot of us, myself included, have been really inspired by the way young people have committed to taking action. And there's been this interesting narrative that on the surface sounds really positive, but I think if you dig deeper, it's problematic. So, the idea is that, young people get us out of this mess. Young people will figure this out. We need to let young people lead the way. And I've been talking to some young people in that particular movement. What I'm hearing from them is, like, you all have a role in this too. Like, we will play our part, but you have a role to play in this too. And in each one of these seven stories, adults played a really important role. Sometimes, I don't want to use this language, but sometimes there's a villain, they're sort of standing in the way, but also really enabling. All these young people talk about a caring adult who took them seriously. All of these young people talk about an adult who helped them think about their impact and drive change. Like, there's a central role we all need to play. Mm-hmm. And my hope is that adults pick up this book and not only get inspired by the stories, but think about how they can build and model these practices themselves.
The book, again, is Putting Peace First, Seven Commitments to Change the World, published by Viking. The author, Eric David Dawson. Eric David Dawson, thank you so much for this important book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
And tomorrow on The Morning Show, a look at the inner workings of the Kenosha Community Foundation with their executive director, Amy Grile, and two other guests. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You'll find The Morning Show archived on our website, wgtd.org. Weather forecast for southeastern Wisconsin and northeastern Illinois is for a partly sunny day today with a high of 50 degrees. Partly cloudy overnight with a low of 40. Friday, a little cloudier than today and a high temperature of 53. And it looks like it will be a mostly cloudy weekend. Just a slight chance of showers each day. Looks like daytime highs will remain in the mid-50s pretty much for the whole weekend. We have NPR News headlines coming up next. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. NPR.